Welcome to Extreme Jeans on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Hello, Jeanies, and welcome to another rip-roaring edition of Extreme Jeans, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeJeans.com. I am Fisher, the Radio Root Sleuth, on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. Huge interest in last week's show with Kenyatta Berry of PBS's Genealogy Roadshow. Anna Mae Waddell of Slidell, Texas, emailed to say she was now excited to get digging further back on her lines now that she knows that there are records on African Americans that predate the 1870 census. And she agrees with Kenyatta that it's an emotional experience to find records of ancestors as property. The first time I came across a record of my slave ancestor, my eyes welled up. Just the idea of it was so horrific. If you missed any of last week's show, be sure to check out the podcast. You can also find it on iTunes, iHeartRadio's Talk Channel, or ExtremeJeans.com. You can also download our free podcast app to your iPhone or Android. It makes it real easy to listen to us wherever you go. You may remember a few weeks ago, I gave a brief mention about working with a friend in identifying her birth mother and the use of a method called triangulation with DNA test. Well, I'd never tried it before myself, but now I have, and my friend Shelley will join us in about 8 minutes. We were able to identify both her birth mother and birth father, and also located a living half-sister as well as a living half-brother. We'll talk about triangulation and other factors that went into these discoveries. And by the way, triangulation doesn't just apply to finding birth families. It can also help you break through lines from much earlier generations. I think you'll find it interesting. I sure did. Then Tom Perry, the Preservation Authority, answers a listener's question about dealing with the effects of humidity on old film and negatives and how you might be able to salvage these badly damaged treasures. It is time once again for your family histoire news from the pages of ExtremeJeans.com. You may recall a while ago our friend Heath Jones from Alabama talked about discovering a live piece of Civil War ordnance and how scary that was. You know, back in 2008, a Civil War enthusiast named Sam White was killed when a naval shell he was trying to disarm exploded. Yeah, from the Civil War. Still, it's pretty rare going back that far. Well, last week in London, an old World War II German bomb from the London air raids was found by builders buried near the studio where Britain's Got Talent is shot and near Wembley Stadium. Homes and businesses had to be evacuated, and the army built a wall surrounding the bomb just in case. It weighed 110 pounds. The bomb has since been removed and safely detonated. Just a little reminder of Adolf's intentions some 75 years ago. Then there was the flip side of this story. In Germany, in the city of Cologne, 20,000 people were forced out of their homes so authorities could disarm a World War II-era Allied bomb that weighed somewhere around 2,000 pounds. It was found close to the Mülheim Bridge that crosses the Rhine River. Schools were shut down, as was the zoo, in what was described as Cologne's largest evacuation of the post-war era. Airspace was closed, and the river was unavailable for shipping. The bomb was found last Friday as workers were preparing for construction of a pipeline. Cologne was a favorite target of Allied bombers during World War II. The bomb was deactivated on Wednesday. On average, 1 to 2 bombs detonate all by themselves each year in Germany with no human assistance. It's rare for people to be killed by these old remnants of the war. In 2006, though, 3 people were killed when a bulldozer struck a bomb. In 2010, 3 more people died when a bomb went off during a defusing operation. It's estimated that it will take until at least the 2040s, 100 years after the war, for all the old bombs in Germany to be cleaned up or not pose a risk to people. Germany finds about 15 bombs a day around the country, but very few are in highly populated areas such as the one in Cologne. It seems crazy to think bombs meant for an enemy in the 1940s might still be killing people 75 years and many other wars later. Imagine being a real estate broker in New York and getting a call asking you to sell a building that housed a business in Harlem started by your great-grandmother 110 years ago. That's what happened to David Daniels of New York's Corcoran Group. Their Brooklyn Heights branch was working on buttoning down a listing for a Harlem townhouse for an estate sale, but distance-wise, it was far from their offices. So they called the West Side office and approached Daniels about handling the sale. When they gave the address and identified it as the Marion Daniels and Sons funeral home, he paused and told them, "You know, Marion Daniels was my great-grandmother." The property had remained in the family since the turn of the last century, and most recently had been in the hands of a second cousin and then that cousin's stepson. It has remained a funeral home this entire time, since 1905. David described it as a very strange feeling to tour prospective buyers through the house that he had known as an ancestral landmark since he was a boy on Long Island. But he noted everything comes to an end, and he found it uniquely pleasing to end what his great-grandmother Marion began all those years ago. Read about this and other stories of interest on our website, extremejeans.com. And coming up, I'll be talking to a Utah woman, Shelley Smith, about the discovery of her late birth mother, her late birth father, and their families, how it all came together, and how the concept of triangulation helped crack the case on the father's side. What is triangulation? We'll tell you about it coming up on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and extremejeans.com. And welcome back to America's Family History Show, Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com. I am Fisher, your radio root sleuth, with my special guest, my friend Shelley Smith from Farmington, Utah. How are you, Shelley?
I'm good. How are you?
You know, anybody who listens to this show knows there's always some genealogical adventure that's going on around here. Of course, we had the murder case a couple of months ago, and then we tracked down the 90-year-old woman who stowed away on a ship to Hawaii with my mother in 1947, tracked her down and got her on. And then Shelley popped in and said, "Hey, I read about this whole thing with the murder case. I didn't know you were so into this stuff. Would you help me with my birth mother?" Shelley, you were born, well, let's just say a long time ago.
True.
And adopted out in the West back in the late 50s. And for all these years, you've been wondering about your birth mother, and you really came armed with a lot of information. I was really impressed.
Well, I've always wondered about finding my parents, and I always grew up knowing that I was adopted. I can't remember my adoptive family ever telling me that I was anything but. So that part was easy. In 1997, I had a bout with cancer, and the doctor asked me if there was any family history of cancer in my family, and we searched some records that we could find and asked for some medical history from the adoption agency where I was placed. And they sent me a sheet with no names, because this was definitely a closed adoption, but they gave me the history of the birth grandmother, grandfather, and then all of the birth mother siblings with their occupation, their weight, their height. I've had this sheet for 18 years, but this sheet was actually one of the key factors in finding my birth mother.
Well, as we know, and we're going to get into the DNA aspect of this in just a little bit, DNA works best when it's in combination with other information, other tools. And that was certainly the case with you, especially in the case of the birth mother. And we're going to talk about the birth mother part right here. And then later in the show, we're going to talk about the birth father, because we found him, too. Both are deceased, but nonetheless, they've been identified and families have been identified. And it was kind of a different technique for that one. So we'll get into that in just a little bit. I was interested in the sheets that the adoption agency provided you, because they did not get into really a lot of the health aspects of the birth mother's family. Wouldn't you agree? Didn't you expect more?
Oh, I was hoping for more. And mostly all it said is it was fair or they were in good health. That's about all the information that they gave me on the medical side.
And so this dated back to the late 50s. And what was interesting is they gave the number of children that were in the family as of that time. And we're talking about the birth mother's family with her as a child. So it showed the birth order of these are the siblings, the son, the son, the son, and then a daughter, and then the birth mother. And then there was another brother of hers after that as well, which was very helpful. No ages, so you really couldn't make a pattern out of this and figure anything out. But then DNA came along, and you got a little gift here at Christmas.
Yes. curious. I had two curious daughters. Actually, they were more curious about the heritage, and they read about doing this DNA test, and you could find the heritage that you belong to. Not knowing any of mine, my oldest daughter decided that she would buy the test, and she was going to do it. And speaking with the younger daughter, she said, why don't we have mom do it? Because that would even be one generation closer.
Exactly.
So for Christmas Eve, they gave me this test, and they kind of laughed and said, well, we kind of want to see. Will you do this? And I said, sure, whatever. And I put it with my Christmas gifts, and it wasn't probably till the middle of January that I was going through things, and I found it, and I thought, I'm going to do this and see what happens.
And so you did, and it was a while later, a few weeks later, as is typical. You got the results that told you exactly what your breakout was, you know, what percent Irish and which part English and French and Eastern European, whatever it might be, right?
Right. It took about 4 weeks, and that came in the mail. My two daughters were in Japan at the time, and so I took a picture of it and sent it to them and closed the email and never thought two things of it, put it on my computer.
And so that was it for you.
Yep, that was it.
And you're just thinking you were done, right?
Sure. I did. I had no idea even how to read it other than, you know, that part. And it was great that we found out that much. That was interesting.
Sure, you felt good about that. And your kids did because they'd bought you the test. And then you found out something new that you hadn't even looked at before.
Yes. We heard a genealogy talk on family history, and they said there had been this breakthrough through this new DNA testing, which my husband and I, we kind of sat up in our chairs and started listening even more careful. And it said, if you did this DNA test where you spit in the cup and you send it in, if you get your sheet back and it says that you have some third and fourth cousins, this is great. If you have some second and third cousins, this is wonderful. But they said, but if you hit a first cousin, you have absolutely hit a jackpot. You will find your family. And he went on to talk about a man who had found his lost family this way. And we were just, we were just gasped by the whole story. And we went back out to the car after this meeting, and we pulled up the DNA on my phone. And sure enough, it said that I had had one first cousin and two first to second cousins, and many, many third and fourth cousins. And it changes every day. The more that I open it, the more cousins, the more people that test, the more there are all the time.
Right. And this is where all of the confirmation started coming in. So you had a first cousin. You don't know which side of the family this relates to, whether it's the father's side or the mother's side. In this case, you had to go to work to figure out where that fit in. So what did you do?
Well, there was a message from one of the cousins that said, clearly, hi, cousin, I'd like to see how we're related. Send me a message sometime. And so we had a couple of things to do that afternoon, and we went that evening, and I sent him a message, and I said, you know, I'd like to know how we're related, because I would have no clue. And I kind of gave him a brief history. I was adopted in 1959 when I was 5 days old. I have no recollection of anything. I have no history. I have no information. And if you can help me anyway, that would be awesome. And so he sent me a message back that very night and said, I was so excited when I got your message. I called my dad right away, and we're going to get on this and see what we can learn, and we'll help you in any way that we can find you. So that really was the first part, the puzzle.
And of course, that turned out to be on the father's side, but we figured that out later. So let's talk about, now you called me to bring me in, and you came in with all these records from your adoption, and you didn't know at that point that you had all this other information, including the family trees of the people you matched to start comparing to.
It kind of was a miracle every single step of the way. I decided to tell one of my friends the incidents that had happened, and the cousin that I had talked to said, send me a picture and we'll see if anybody in our family looks like you. And they sent me a picture of his great-grandmother, and we put it side by side by me, and there was such resemblance. It was just incredible.
And yet resemblance is kind of like a piece of sky in a jigsaw puzzle if you don't have any context to it.
Oh, absolutely. So many people have always said, oh, you look so familiar. Who do you belong to? And I thought, you know, I really don't know. I just have a generic face anyway. So anyway, the picture wasn't that big of a deal at that point. And so the first person that I told, I was telling her, and she said, you know any names on this side of the family? And I said, some. And I told her, and she just sat there with wide eyes and said, my husband is from this family. So she pulled out all her genealogy sheets that she had, and she started to explain all about this genealogy. And that really, really was the factor that made me so interested. All of a sudden, I just felt like it is time. I would love to find my birth family.
Wow. And all these years later. And that's when you called me.
Yes. So then I kind of ran into a dead end. I felt like 3 or 4 weeks I'd played with this. I wasn't finding anything. He was trying to find, I shared the adoption papers with them. They were trying to find a particular family that had a birth order, and he had gone through many, many cousins, and that wasn't working out. And so my husband had seen this article that you had found, you know, the family of this body that they had found by where we live. And so he said, I think you should call him. And my oldest daughter said, yes, Fisher knows everything. He's a genealogy genius. And so I decided to call you and see what we could put together.
Oh, it was very fun when you came by that night and we started going through, and you really hadn't had any contact with the first cousin that you had on your list. And and you hadn't seen her tree yet either. We actually had to activate some things so that you could see that.
Boy, once we got the trees going, then we knew names and things started to fall into place. All these years that it's taken me, it only took us a few hours to find this.
That's true. And we had to start sorting it out and seeing what errors might be in the record and what matched up. And as we went through it, we started to see that this first cousin's line, which was all there, it showed her mother in this one particular family. And it showed her parents and her siblings. And the pattern looked very similar to what you had from the adoption agency, the brothers in order, the two girls and the parents. And then, of course, we started going back to the census of 1940 because those give educational levels at that point. And that actually matched up with what the adoption agency said. I thought it was really weird that the adoption agency would give education levels for each member of this birth family, and they matched.
Absolutely. And we had to look at the picture as of the late 50s, because if we would have looked at the family all over, they had had two previous children that had passed away. So that would not have matched.
Right.
Remember how we had to pull that in.
Yeah, exactly. And so now you kind of had an idea where your mother fit in. And then we started narrowing it down and figured out exactly who she was. And then went online and found her obituary. You found you have a half sister. How did that feel?
Well, I kind of knew about her because on the adoption papers that they had sent, the history did say that she had a six-year-old with her at the time. However, she looked absolutely opposite of I. Blonde hair, blue eyes.
Oh, they described her. That's right.
Fair skin. Yes, they described her. Yeah. So I have known about her. So that has been really interesting. And I've had those papers for 18 years. So 18 years, you know, I have absolutely known that I've had a half-sister possibly 6 years older than myself.
And now you have reached out to her, and just Saturday you heard back.
Yes, that was amazing. That was truly amazing. You know, we're still kind of putting the pieces together. It's still unfamiliar territory for both of us. We'd like to put the pieces of our mother's life together. She had no idea that I even existed. So this was quite the shock for her, I believe.
Yeah, I bet.
The shock that I still live, and a part of her mother's life that she had not shared with her. So that was kind of interesting.
I think you thought it was pretty much done at that point, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah, I honestly did.
But then there was that other side we had to look into, and that was the birth father. And that took an entirely different strategy, and we will talk about that coming up next. Triangulation. Can you do it if you're looking for a birth family? We'll explain how it works next on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Welcome back to Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeGenes.com. Fisher here, the Radio Root Sleuth, talking to Shelley Smith, who just a few weeks ago discovered her birth mother with a little assist from yours truly. And then we went forward and actually were able to identify your birth father, Shelley. And I think that was a bonus even you didn't expect.
Oh, for sure. It was about 10 days later. I had spoken with my first cousin on the mother's side, and I was curious. I said, do you know anything about the father? I have two other first cousins. And she was more curious after that. She said, you have two cousins from the father's side. And it just hit me. I have two cousins from the father's side. So we kind of searched through cousin lines to see if we could tie the common ancestor together with the two cousins that they had provided with the DNA results.
All right. And this is called triangulation. And triangulation works like this. If two people are cousins to each other and you're a cousin to both of them, there is a likelihood that you descend from the same people. And so we actually took that tact with these two cousins. Now, the cousins showed up as between first and second cousins, which generally means first cousin once removed or a second cousin, because if they were first, they'd show up as a first cousin. as was the case with your birth mother's relative that showed up as a first cousin. So in this case, we went through and found the trees. These two people did not know each other. One is older, lives in Indiana. He's a first cousin twice removed to this younger man. And they both came from the same folks, obviously, going back to 1862. The couple was born in 1862. And so here's how triangulation works. We were able to determine then that this couple born in 1862 had 10 children, and we knew that your father had to come from the next generation.
Yep, that's right.
And so from those 10 children, that's where you start going through and saying, all right, on the lines that are posted on various websites, who are the children of those 10 children? And in this case, we identified one person who was born in the early 1920s who fit the bill perfectly because, again, there was a description in your adoptive family's profile that you'd received.
That's right. It said the father's age, approximately, and then it said that he was divorced, and then in parentheses it says two previous marriages. So we searched for a child that could have been in that particular family in that particular time frame.
Right.
And we found one family that they only had one son that was living during that time, and that would have to definitely be the father.
The birth father. That's right. And he was one of the children of the 10 children, and out of them all, he was the only one who fit. So that looked like a pretty good case there. And it also had mentioned in your profile that he had had two previous children, and he fit that profile as well. So the case kept getting better and better. And I remember talking with you late that night, and our heads are swimming in this thing. And that's the thing about it that gets so exciting, is you start to make this headway of breaking a lifelong case, Shelley, and your head can't stop even when you try to hit the pillow.
Oh, no. Sleepless nights, for sure. Many sleepless nights. You wake up and you think things through again, and you have to go search more. And at that point, you come up with a hypothesis and you prove it to be a theory. And sure enough, here's the theory.
Exactly. And you had sent over to me, going back to what you'd mentioned previously, a photograph of a woman who would have been in the generation of a grandmother who looked a lot like you. Now, previously, we said, well, that's kind of like a piece of sky on a jigsaw puzzle. But when suddenly that person happens to fit into this particular family, she would have been the mother of your birth father. Now it takes on a whole different perspective.
Yes. That first picture that they ever sent me, they said, my father thinks that you look like my great-grandmother. And it absolutely turned out to be my grandmother in the picture.
Yes. And this is what got my head spinning. Here it is. It's like 1 o'clock in the morning and my eyes suddenly pop wide open. It's like, well, you've got to have DNA matches to this grandmother's parents' lines. And so I went back on the computer and logged into your account and started going through those lines and picking out the names of the ancestors of who we thought would be your birth grandmother. So now we're going up the paternal grandmother's side. We're picking out her parents. We're going through her grandparents and great-grandparents and getting those names. And so that's where you throw the filter onto all of your matches and see if those names come up. And boy, it was pretty cool when we did that, because out of your second, third, and fourth cousins, there had to have been at least a dozen matches to both the mother and the father's families of your paternal grandmother.
Yep. And that just seals the deal.
Yeah, pretty much sealed the deal right there. And one of those first cousins once removed, he's the younger one. He has a mom still living who would be your first cousin. So she's in the process of doing a DNA test right now.
Yeah. And not that we absolutely need it, because we have her son that has already matched as a first cousin once removed.
Right.
But for curiosity, and the more people that you get tested, the more sure that you are. And so we will have her do it just to see if she comes up as a first cousin.
Absolutely. And what's interesting, too, is this particular person we picked out of all the grandchildren came from the one little town that the cousin of your birth mother suggested he should have been from.
Yeah, another miracle. It just is like a piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, all puzzle pieces. So on this side, you found out you actually have a living half-brother who is still out there, but he hasn't yet been informed, as I understand it.
Or in the process.
Right. And, you know, this is something we ought to talk about a little bit, because with social media, there is so much fast communication that things can get ahead of themselves a little bit, and that can get a little bit scary.
Oh, it can. The minute that we shared it with my own children, who are Facebook prodigy age, they set out to find anything that they possibly could. And you have to realize that these are people's lives. You know what I mean? You can't just come into a life and expect nothing to change, because it changes everything.
Yes.
When you know you have a half brother or half sister out there, and where did they come from, and why wasn't this shared, and things like that. Even though you see a lot of television shows that it becomes picture perfect, it's not always picture perfect that way.
Well, that's right. And with all the interaction with Facebook and Twitter and the like, and of course you're in touch with these cousins that you matched up with on your DNA test.
Yeah, they don't live nearby. They are out of state, so it's kind of tricky getting things together. And we are so excited to meet each other. That part, I think, will be good.
And so how did you decide you were going to handle it with the half-brother?
We're going to let the first cousin talk to him first and see what she could learn. And then she was going to report back and see if he would talk to me that way and see if we can fit some other pieces together. I'm not sure that he knows that I even existed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, probably so. The father's side is often less likely than even the mother's side to know of another child out there.
Well, all I know is for many years it was like finding a needle in a haystack. And with this DNA result, it suddenly makes everything real.
Yeah, I bet. And so how are you feeling about this? I mean, you started with the test. I mean, I love that. The gift that keeps on giving, the gift of spit, back over the holidays. and you did it finally in January. You got your results in March. And now here it is several months later, and you're still going with it. You're still developing relationships. You're still learning things, finding things out about yourself. How does that change how you perceive yourself, and how does it change what you thought you would think about your birth parents?
Well, adoption is kind of tricky that way. If anyone that has been adopted will know, once you find out that you're adopted, you're always curious about it. And you almost put your birth family up on a pedestal. And honestly, I really only wanted to meet my birth mother for one thing, was to thank her so much for placing me and giving me something in life that she thought would have been the best for me. And that's all. And all of a sudden, I realize I have a huge family out there, and my kids are interested in the family. And, you know, it's not just me. It's never about yourself. And it is an emotional roller coaster. You have tears and you worry, and then it's joy and fascination and all these things that are happening. And you just, it's just really unsettled.
Yeah, I'll bet. And, you know, it doesn't look like it's going to slow down anytime soon. You've got reunion season coming up. Have you heard anything about that?
Yep, a couple of them, both sides of the family.
Well, Shelley, it's been an honor to work with you on this thing, and a thrill to be a part of it with you. I've never done triangulation before, personally. I've heard about it. I've read how it works with close cousins, where they're cousins to each other and you're a cousin to them. Then you come through the same people. But never saw it actually work before until this opportunity came along. Hopefully, it's something that's going to help somebody else who is out there also trying to put things together, and not necessarily in an adoptive sense, but maybe with a generation or two further back, where they're trying to start to figure out exactly where they fit in their family tree.
Oh, absolutely. Help those trees grow.
Thank you so much, Shelley. Good to have you on.
Hey, thank you. And thank you so much. I can't even thank you enough.
And we are back. Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Fisher here, the Radio Root Sleuth, with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com, the Preservation Authority. Hi, Tom. Good to see you again.
Hello. Good to be seen.
Got an email from Cal Jackson, listening on WTKI in Huntsville, Alabama, asking not only about the heat that we were talking about last week, but he says, I got to deal with humidity as well. Does this add any further complications to preservation of old film?
Oh, yeah, that makes the worst even worster, if you can say that. Heat is bad, but there's nothing worse than humidity.
Really? Okay,
oh, yeah.
Even with movie film?
Oh, absolutely.
Huh.
The biggest problem with that is you have two things you're fighting. First, the film gets damp because of humidity.
Right.
And so it kind of sticks to each other. And then when it dries, it pulls that humidity out. And so now they're pretty much permanently stuck to each other. So if you start pulling them apart, the emulsions from one side is going to transfer to the other side.
Oh, boy.
And it's going to be a mess. You won't be able to see a picture on part of your film. You'll see double exposure on the other one that's like a backwards echo, and it will drive you nuts.
Oh, my goodness. So is this something that's ever salvageable, or just once in a while salvageable?
Every experience is different. Sometimes you get them, if they're not too bad, you can actually soak them. And kind of like we talked about last week with 35 millimeter frame by frame film, you can get them wet and then hang them up, put them through a dryer system that will allow them not to be stuck to each other.
Wow.
But that's about the only way you can do that. And we have pictures where people have been in a place like Huntsville, Alabama, and they have photos, the same thing. It gets humid in there, and the glossy side of the picture stick to each other, and then it dries, and so now they're hardened against each other.
Oh.
It's like Back to the Future type thing. You've got to go and take these pictures, soak them in the right kind of bath, and then gently, when they're soft enough, pull them apart. And then if you want them to be glossy again, you've got to go to a photo retailer or somebody like us, and then we can put them on what's called a chrome dryer, and that'll make them glossy again.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, that sounds, first of all, very labor-intensive.
Oh, it is.
And number two, very expensive.
Oh, it can be. It can be very expensive. And it's one of those things you don't want to try at home.
Right.
Because if you don't know what you're doing, I guarantee you're going to damage your pictures and then they'll be lost.
Right. So you need an expert to take a crack at it if you're willing to pay the price.
Right. Yeah. And if you go and talk to somebody and it's like way out of the price range that you were looking for, go ahead and try and do it yourself, because that's the only alternative you have. And if you really get in that kind of spot, send us a letter at asktom@tmcplace.com. And I'll try and walk you through it and find out what your exact predicament is and see how I can help you with it.
Boy. That just sounds like a horrible thing for Cal, and I feel for him because, you know, this is family history gold, those old home movies.
Oh, yeah, the old home movies, the photos, all those kind of things.
If people have damaged stuff, and apparently a lot of them do when they finally come across old film or old movies or whatever it might be, is there some way to at least stop the damage until they're ready to go try to get that salvaged and digitized?
Absolutely. In fact, that's a good question. There's ways to kind of prolong the damage, and there's also ways to stop it. And there's two sides to this sword, and it's actually a good sword. If you're not ready to transfer it, it's important to preserve it. If you've already had it transferred, you still want to preserve it, so you've got an analog copy of everything that you've done. Okay, so one of the best ways to do it in high humidity areas, anytime you have humidity, which is really, really hard to control, the heat's a lot easier to control than the humidity is. And so what you want to do, you want to get something that's going to take the humidity away from the product that you're trying to save. And it's always like the weakest link is the one that breaks.
Sure.
So you want to make the weakest link, not your photos, not your film, not your videotapes. So what I recommend is you get uncooked rice and not the instant minute rice. And then what you do with this, you get like some broadcloth or some cheesecloth and wrap a half a cup in it or whatever, how big your box is going to be. And then you want to make sure you tie it off with string. Don't use a rubber band or paper clips or anything.
Right.
That could add, you know, more problems. Rubber bands will break. The paper clips could discolor or even rust your items.
Right.
So you want to tie it off and then put that in the box or, if possible, in like a Ziploc bag, because a Ziploc bag will help keep stuff out of there. And then by putting the rice in there, if somehow humidity still gets introduced into your box, your bags or whatever, it will absorb it. Now, a thing that's important to do, you want to check it seasonal, just like you check your smoke detectors when, you know, daylight savings time starts and stops.
Right, every 6 months or something.
Exactly. Do the same thing with the rice. Go in and check it. And the best thing to do, rice is cheap, just throw it away and put some new rice in there. And always, you know, use new cheesecloth, new broadcloth. Just throw the whole packet away and start new and don't try to eat it.
Don't try to eat it. Who would eat it?
You know,
no.
I have a 13-year-old, and it's kind of interesting what he'll eat. No, but I mean, it's really funny. I mean, that sounds so stupid, but I've learned you never assume. Throw it away. There can be bugs and all kinds of stuff that has gotten absorbed into the rice, so you want to make sure you get it away. And that's another thing that's important, too, where you have high humidity and where you have a hot place where it doesn't get really cold, you're going to have bugs. So you want to make sure that your boxes, your bags, everything are sealed tightly, because you don't want rodents getting in there and eating your stuff.
Yeah, have you actually seen that? Well, I certainly have with photographs, you know, where the edges have been nibbled on or something.
Yeah, we've had people bring in old needle points. It was, you know, great-great-grandmothers that they wanted to scan to have it preserved. And you could see where there had been some mice that had, you know, used it as a bathroom. They had used it to try to make a nest out of it. You want to make sure that they're in something that's very practical. Like, I've seen people get fireproof safes. So if they ever have a fire, it's in that safe, but then they go an extra mile and they put it in a, like a giant cooler. Because
right.
Because that will keep the heat away too. And you don't have to go to an expensive cooler. You can go to Home Depot or Lowe's and get sheets of styrofoam and build a box to go around your other box, which is great for shipping stuff. In fact, whenever people ship us records across the country, we always tell them put them in a box and put styrofoam all around the record. So when it's going through the UPS trucks across the country, the heat of the truck's not going to make your record go wobbly.
All right. Great advice, Tom. Thanks so much. Good to have you.
Good to be here again.
Hey, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. Thanks also to Shelley Smith for coming on and talking about her successful journey to find the families of both her birth mother and birth father. If you missed the segments, be sure to catch the podcast and learn about the concept of DNA triangulation. Talk to you next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.